This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we learn about houseplants in advance of National Take Your Houseplants Out for a Walk Day. Yep, it's real. But we are going to start today with an edible forest. Try before you buy. That's why we test drive cars or try on clothes. Have you thought about this for gardening? The Northern Plains Botanic Garden Society is hosting tours of an edible forest with dozens of species and cultivars of cold, hardy fruits. Did you know people are growing nuts and kiwi in North Dakota? You can see for yourself on a tour where you can compare a full-size apple tree with a dwarf variety to see what works for you. I got a tour with Jim Walla, a volunteer with the Northern Plains Botanic Garden Society, who says tours are for people interested in planting fruit, especially if they want to go beyond the common ones, like apples and raspberries.
And we have those, but we have some variations on those too, so that people can learn a little bit more about them. For instance, we have them apples on dwarf, semi-dwarf, and standard rootstock. So side by side, the same variety, so people can see over long term what those different rootstocks will do, how the trees will perform on those different kinds of rootstocks. But then we go beyond the average kind of fruit that's grown here.
Mm-hmm.
We have seedless grapes. We do have blueberries. Blueberries don't grow in our soil, so we can amend the soil. We put them in beds with a lower pH. We have probably the most unusual is persimmons.
What? Here?
Yes, here. We don't have any fruit. The plants are still very small.
Okay.
But they've survived a couple winters now so far, and they're growing, and they should be hardy here. The plants will be hardy here. The question will be how often the fruit will mature here.
Okay.
Persimmons need to have a full season to mature and then get a hard freeze.
That part we can promise, the hard freeze.
We'll get a hard freeze. but will that come before the fruits are mature?
Yeah.
And I'm expecting about 50% of the years that we'll get that. Well, 50%, that's not, people can think of that as a glass half full or half empty. And just depends on how they look at it. A lot of our fruits have failure years. We might get a late freeze to reduce our apple crop.
Okay.
And so looking at it the same way, it's getting something like a persimmon
in
North Dakota would be, half the years would be amazing.
Well, let's talk about those tricks here, because you said this is a demonstration orchard. Are you talking, you're working with, you know, the U of M and NDSU Extension, or you're working more with local gardeners, you're working with market producers?
All of the above. Okay. This is for anybody that's interested in fruit.
What's your interest in fruit?
When I was little, I can remember helping my dad and my grandpa prune their fruit trees and helping harvest and all that. And from that time on, I've just had fruit trees. And in our yard at home, we have 10 or 12 kinds of fruit trees and shrubs. And I grow just as much as I can. When I worked at NDSU before I retired, some of my research projects involved diseases of fruit trees, choke cherries and June berries and such.
Yeah.
And so just over a lifetime, my interest has developed.
Well, this forest pathology, and that's what you were doing with NDSU for your career. When we talk about diseases that are impacting trees, talk about the importance of diversity when it comes to disease tolerance.
Yeah, diversity is critical. If you have all one kind of plant and a disease comes in, it will affect all of your plants. If you have a diverse range of types of plants, a disease comes in. Most diseases are pretty specific to one kind of plant or just a few kinds of plants. So if you have diversity, then it will only affect a few kind of plants. That will make it easier to control or to manage in an orchard. And if it can't be controlled, then you'll only lose a little bit compared to losing everything.
What's going on over here at this pergola? I see a couple of kind of small plants here. Looks like they are, it's assumed they're going to get a lot bigger based on the structure they've been planted by. The Arctic Beauty Kiwi. This is not something I would anticipate seeing in a climate like ours. Despite the word Arctic in there, I'm focusing here on the word kiwi.
This is our Arctic Kiwi pergola. And it is intended for this, for the kiwi plants to grow over it and provide shade, a nice setting for people to relax in our edible forest. There are three types of kiwi: a fuzzy kiwi that people buy in the store, a hardy kiwi, which is a vine that people that are hardy to about 25 below, and Arctic Beauty kiwi that's hardy, a vine that's hardy to about 40 below. People, I know a number of people in North Dakota that are growing Arctic Beauty Kiwi, and they are hardy here. They do produce here. Ours aren't doing great. You're right. They look like they are intended to cover the pergola, but they haven't done that yet. There's a little bit of increased vigor. I haven't grown them before, and so part of it is a learning curve. I think part of it, it might be some kind of soil issue. We're giving the plants a little bit of time and hoping that they'll take off. And this one that in front of us, September Sun, cultivar of Arctic Beauty Kiwi, is doing better this year than it has in past years. So maybe it's coming along. If it's not, if it doesn't, in another year or two, we'll move it a little bit and try to deal with some of the possible soil issues. Arctic Beauty Kiwi, the fruit tastes just like fuzzy kiwi that you buy in the store. They're just smaller berries. There are getting to be bigger and bigger berry selections of Arctic Beauty Kiwi, and September Sun is one of the bigger ones. Victor is an even bigger one, so they're getting to be grape size. So they're not in the same range as the fuzzy kiwis, but a grape size kiwi that you can grow here in North Dakota that tastes like the kiwis that you buy in the store is a nice addition to what we can grow here.
It looks like we're coming up on some grapes. The cold hardy grape has been around a couple of decades, developed again by a couple of universities in this area. Now, these are a table grape. Are the cold hardy grapes that have been developed around here, were those mostly for wine? Were they mostly for eating out of hand like this?
University of Minnesota has been developing cold hardy grapes for a long time. And there are some private breeders that have been developing cold hardy grapes for a longer time. And that's both wine grapes and table grapes. North Dakota State University has been involved in wine grape development for some time now, several years, and we have a couple of their pre-release selections in our orchard. My understanding that they will make the most cold hardy wine grapes of the highest quality in the world. So it's an exciting development that could change the whole developing wine industry in North Dakota and adjacent northern Minnesota and on up into Canada.
We are standing amongst raspberries here. Roughly how many different cultivars of raspberries are we looking at here?
We have 9 cultivars of red raspberries, 3 of yellow raspberries, 3 of black raspberries, 3 of purple raspberries, and then we have 4 blackberry cultivars. There are hundreds of kinds of red raspberries.
Yeah.
Within red raspberries, there's a lot of different traits. Important for us in North Dakota is that they mature early enough for our growing season and that they survive our winters.
Are you doing any breeding?
I've done some crosses for apples and apricots. And I've done some selections for mulberries.
I've heard there's something special about mulberries here.
Yeah, we have a trader mulberry. Trader is the family name of a person that brought a bunch of fruit trees to the United States when he immigrated from Germany in the 1860s. That trader mulberry is still on the original homestead up by Valley City. Tree is still alive and producing berries. Short tail relative of the family contacted me about propagating after they had difficulty, and I was able to propagate it. And after a few years, we decided, you know, this has really good traits. Let's talk about releasing as a new cultivar. It was patented as a cultivar in 2016, and I've been selling it out of my little backyard nursery for several years now, and it's been picked up by some other nurseries. We've licensed some other nurseries now, and it's coming on the market, on a larger market commercially.
What is the process of patenting and licensing?
Well, I understand you can patent a plant by yourself. It's a lot more detailed than what I care to get into. There's enough legal things that it's sort of like drawing up your own will. You can do it yourself, but but you might make some mistakes and you don't want to do that. So we went to a patent attorney. Basically, we needed to come up with a very good description of the plant, all the leaf traits, all the berry traits, the bark traits, the plant hardiness traits, those kind of things. Compare it with any other similar plants to show that it was really something new.
Yeah.
And once we did that, then the patent attorney took it the rest of the way and submitted it to the U.S. Patent Office. And after a couple of years, then it was approved and patented.
Anything else you want to show me?
Let's talk about the nut trees.
What kind of nuts are we talking here?
We have chestnuts.
Okay.
We have pecans. We have hickories. We can grow walnuts and butternuts here, but we don't have any in our orchard. Our space in the orchard is fairly limited.
Yeah, how big of a space is this?
It's about 1 acre. So here's a northern pecan, ultra northern pecan. Pecans that you buy in the store are southern pecans. They can be grown maybe up into Kansas and Missouri.
Okay.
But once you get into Kansas and Missouri, they need a little bit more hardiness to be really productive on a long-term basis. So they have more there, what are called northern pecans.
Mm-hmm.
And those are selections that were selected from native plant material discovered along rivers, like the Mississippi River and the Ohio River. And so they have a little bit better hardiness.
Mm-hmm.
In general, the northern pecans aren't as large as the southern pecans. And then you get into North Dakota, what can grow here? Well, they pushed a little bit further and they discovered some pecans growing along the upper Mississippi, along the Iowa-Illinois border. And those are considered ultra-northern pecans. That's the furthest north that pecans have been found in their native range.
Do we think that these are planted by humans or squirrels, or how did they get up there?
The thought is that Native Americans moved them along, but I don't know that there's any documentation of any of that.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Hmm.
So ultra-northern pecans are, the tree is fully hardy in North Dakota and on up into Canada.
Wow.
But the nuts don't mature here. In order to get pecans, you have to have a tree that's hardy, and you have to have a nut that matures within our growing season.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a few cultivars of ultra-northern pecan that will mature in our growing season. There's a person in Bismarck that's been growing nuts for a long time, so he's done some background. I was able to talk to him and get some information. He's got one that's called P3 pecan that was selected by a person named Carl Weschke, who was a tree nut. It fits. In the Twin Cities, he was actually a medical doctor that had a passion about growing nut trees. And he had pecans and hickories and chestnuts and hazelnuts and a wide range of different kinds of nuts on his farm in adjacent Wisconsin. And P3 pecan is one that was discovered after he died in his orchard. And it produces mature nuts in Bismarck about every other year, about 50% of the years. Again, we'd like them to be every year, but every other year for getting pecans in North Dakota is a pretty good deal.
Seems pretty great.
In Fargo, we have more heating degree days, heat units okay. within our growing season. This particular tree is planted on the south side of a windbreak, which is going to add heat units. I expect once this tree comes into bearing age, if we have the right cultivars of pecan on it, we will get pecans almost every year, if not every year. Hmm. At least 70%, I'm estimating,
yeah.
which is a big deal for North Dakota.
Yeah, that is.
Ultra-northern pecans are smaller than southern pecans, but when I eat a southern pecan, I really like it, but when I eat a bunch of them, there's kind of a background bitter taste.
Mm.
Ultra-northern pecans don't have that background bitter taste. They're just the sweet, nutty pecan flavor.
Hmm.
So the reward is smaller, but better.
Well, I'm honestly surprised not to hear that there could be a nut tree that comes into, you know, a harvestable yield in North Dakota, as much as that you said it was around the Bismarck area, because only 2% of North Dakota has any kind of measurable forest here, and a lot of that is on the eastern part as you start to get closer and closer into Minnesota. There's a lot more moisture. Trees in the nut family typically tend to be very water intensive to grow. As you start to get out to Bismarck and west, you start to run into a lot more of that arid kind of western climate. Do you find that you end up having to do, not exactly like an east versus west cultivar, but differences even just within North Dakota of the same cultivar?
Oh, there's so many variations on that question. Last year in Bismarck, on my friend's P3 pecan, his trees did struggle, and they grew, had almost no growth last year, and they were really struggling. You're right. The thought is that the drought last year that was so severe did damage that. And so we've talked about that. There's another possible rootstock for pecans, a bitternut hickory as a possible rootstock that would be more drought hardy, that might do better in western North Dakota. So we've talked about that possibility. And I have some bitternut hickory rootstocks in my little nursery in my backyard that I'm going to be grafting some pecans onto to try just that. The problem is, in our area, our heavy clay soils in the Red River Valley
mm-hmm.
are the opposite extreme. Many of the nut trees don't handle heavy soils. They
right.
need more oxygen in their roots than what our heavy clay soils might provide.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to adjust for each different condition. And you probably have to be a plant nerd to figure out.
You got to know where the microclimates are.
What's going to work for each kind of plant to do its best.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're looking for. I've identified about a dozen different pecans cultivars just based on going through the literature that have a short enough growing season to mature in North Dakota, in fact, probably some up to the Canadian border,
mm-hmm.
That I think we can be using here. Now there's only one kind been grown, so now we need to try those different kinds. On this particular pecan, I'll be grafting different types
mm-hmm.
and top working it.
What does top working mean?
Top working means grafting a different kind of pecan onto different branches of the tree. So we'll have different cultivars of pecans growing on this same tree, and over time we'll be able to tell which ones are going to mature the most often and maybe be the best quality nut as far as cracking, as far as taste, as far as season length. All those kind of things.
Yeah.
So on one tree, we can evaluate a bunch of different things.
Well, you really have to think about not just how the food will grow, but the experience of eating the food, even just how that nut will crack, will make a world of difference if you are trying to launch this into the consumer market. If it's not something that consumers are going to use, how much time do you spend thinking about just, you know, is this food good?
I've thought about that for every plant that's in here. In my view, every plant that's in here has good fruit. I've avoided planting some kinds of fruit just because I don't think that fruit is good. Mm. The problem is that's a personal conclusion.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I think is good or not good may not fit with the next person's thought of what's good and not good. And so I try not to limit it too much that way, but how can I avoid my personal biases?
Without getting too thick into the weeds here and too deep into the science, but in just general terms, when it comes to developing cold hardiness, what do you have to do to plants and to trees to try to make them more able to tolerate some of these temperatures and the winds that we get around here?
There's a lot of aspects to that, and yeah, try to not get into the weeds.
Yeah.
There's a theory, and I think it's established, that a plant that is not so hardy here, if it grows here and produces fruit, that fruit somehow is more cold tolerant. So you experiment with plants that aren't quite cold tolerant and get some fruit from those in those years that you're lucky to get fruit, and then you plant that out, and that's liable to be more cold tolerant. Mm. That's the theory, and it's apparently well established. But there are other things. So some people think, well, my plant isn't quite cold tolerant, so I'm going to plant it on the south side of my house, and that'll give it some more warmth.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly the opposite of what you want to do. For growing apricots, they aren't cold tolerant in terms primarily that their flowers bloom too early for us. And we often get spring freezes, and that takes out our crop. That's the most limiting thing on apricots here. Well, so people plant them on the south side of their house, so they get even earlier flowering, and that's a mistake. Plant them in a site where the soil remains cold, but the plant grows up into the sunshine, and that will result in that plant flowering later. You can plant it, you can manage the snow, you can put up a snow fence and cause a bigger snowdrift where that tree is growing, so that maybe you gain a week. The snow melts, maybe it'll take a week for that snow to melt compared to the surrounding area, and you gain a week. That can avoid a frost for you. That can make a big difference in getting fruit production.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, you're welcome. Pleasure to do this.
That was Jim Walla, a volunteer with the Northern Plains Botanic Garden Society. The next public tour of the edible forest is tomorrow at 10 a.m., or you can go to their website to schedule a private tour. That conversation was also about twice as long as what aired, and you can hear the whole version on the Main Street page at prairiepublic.org.
Sleepy Hollow Theater and Arts Park in Bismarck presents Legally Blonde the Musical, July 28th through August 6th. Meet sorority girl Elle Woods, who enrolls at Harvard Law School to win back her ex-boyfriend, but in the process discovers how her newfound knowledge of the law can help others. And even though very few have faith in Elle, she manages to surprise them all when she successfully defends exercise queen Brooke Wyndham in a murder trial while staying true to herself. Tickets available now online at shtap.org, by phone at 701-319-0894, or at the gate.
Still to come on Main Street, what paying attention to houseplants can teach us about ourselves. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. States such as Minnesota have made progress in renewable energy output, but a lack of grid capacity has created a logjam, preventing some projects from moving forward. However, a decision issued Monday bodes well for such efforts in the Midwest. The Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, or MISO, approved a $10 billion investment for 18 long-term transmission projects for its Midwest subregion. Natalie McIntyre of the Clean Grid Alliance calls the action monumental amid the push for a carbon-free future under goals set out by state governments and utilities themselves.
We're trying to meet the needs of utilities as they're planning for shifting towards clean energy resources that both benefit the environment but also have low cost to consumers.
Following the recent spike in energy prices, supporters of fossil fuels want to slow the closing of coal plants to meet current demands, But those backing renewables argue it's still more cost-effective to stay on the clean energy path. And McIntyre says the transmission projects approved by MISO allow for flexibility as innovation evolves.
Our generation mix and the technologies are changing so rapidly that it's hard to know exactly where we're going.
McIntyre says building more capacity for a variety of clean energy resources paves the way for a more reliable grid.
The transmission grid that we're building for the future is one that we expect to be much more reliable in terms of being able to continue to meet consumer electricity demands during winter storms and during the summer when we have high heat indexes.
Officials say the new lines should add as much as 53 gigawatts of renewables and battery storage, enough to power about 12 million homes and create about 200,000 jobs. And he was a pioneer in Native American journalism. 88-year-old Tim Gallego passed away July 24th in Rapid City. Gallego was a trailblazer who started the first independent Native American-owned newspaper, the Lakota Times, on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation. In an interview with Prairie Public's Dave Thompson in 1982, Gallego talked about the challenge of having the first independently owned newspaper in Indian country and how there was pushback from the tribes at first.
Tribes have been maligned so long for so many years by the mainstream media that they have a dreaded suspicion of the media, and so many of the things that they have done in a good way has failed to make the media and newspapers, and a lot of the good things are just pushed aside, and a lot of the bad things come out in the front in the papers. And I think the tribes and the tribal people, tribal leaders just got tired of that.
At the time of his death, Gallego was the publisher of the Native Sun News Today, headquartered in Rapid City. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Cottonwood Bluegrass Band invites you to the 10th Annual Bluegrass Goes Pink, a fundraiser benefiting the Bismarck Cancer Center Foundation on Saturday, July 30th at the Cross Ranch State Park near Washburn. You could start your morning with a fun 5 or 10K walk or run on the scenic trails of Cross Ranch. Then supper will be served by the Washburn churches at 5 and a concert by Cottonwood Bluegrass Band at 7 p.m. Wear pink and enjoy some bluegrass and support cancer awareness with Bluegrass Goes Pink, July 30th. More information online at cottonwoodbluegrass.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and people tend to be pretty verbal. We communicate with words. Thanks for listening to a show with a lot of words on it. But we do communicate with plants as well. When you pay attention to your houseplants, they're telling you about their needs. And it's an act of love to listen so deeply. And there is a whole holiday dedicated to saying thanks to our houseplants. It's tomorrow. It's called National Take Your Houseplants Out for a Walk Day. This is an effort to pay a little more attention to those houseplants and the important things they're doing in our lives. I visited with Jacqueline Weber, who has been known to carry around a houseplant or two. Jacqueline, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be here. And glad to join you.
Do you remember which plant is your first love?
Sage. Always sage.
Yeah?
Yes.
What is it about sage?
I guess it's in the word and in the plant. Mm. The word itself meaning knowledge, and wisdom keepers have been known as sages, and I think the plant in and of itself gives us a little bit of wisdom as well. People have been burning it for years to clear the bad energy out of rooms, and we can eat it and burn it and let it flower and just bask in its glory, and it smells amazing.
What does a phrase like wisdom keeper mean to you?
I guess old knowledge, something that is gained just by living and interacting in nature, and that connection to earth and all of the beautiful plants and vegetation that occurs, and all things wild.
But houseplants sort of live, you know, like one of those cats that's an indoor-outdoor cat. They're a little bit wild. They're a little bit domesticated. What are houseplants doing for us?
Well, they're clearing the air in our houses. They are known to pull toxins out of the air, not to mention in the middle of winter, and we have an awful lot of that up here in the North Country. They give us a little bit of green to cheer our spirits in the midst of all that whiteness.
Yeah, right now it's easy. We're sitting amongst 18 different shades of green and there are blossoms everywhere. But that February when it feels like there is nothing, there is no hope for us. Even sometimes the full moon of February is called the starving moon. I mean, this is a time of scarcity.
And despair.
And despair. She lowers her head. But I know that you are growing figs here in this zone, and that sometimes you have to be taking those in. Let's talk about this approach to plants that aren't necessarily from here and navigating these seasons and what we can learn about being human by following those plants.
Well, it's a little bit cold here for most of the year, and so it's hard to grow a lot of the plants that exist in the world. So there is a method of simply bringing them inside with us and caring for them in the heat of our houses in the midst of winter. Figs do not grow in Zone 4. This is Zone 4, where very few things grow, fruiting trees and such. So we take our figs inside. They lose their leaves, which is sad, as I have really large sticks coming out of pots for several months of the winter, taking up a lot of space. However, when you hit February and the depths of all that cold and whiteness, they grow amazingly large leaves, bloom out, and give us all sorts of joy and such.
Yeah. What happens to you when you see that? I saw your smile, but for the radio audience here, who didn't get to see that?
It's hope, right? It's spring. It's the assurance that things continue to bloom all year round, and it just brings me joy.
Now, this is a joy that you do try to spread in your professional life. You are an English teacher at Morehead High. You have been known to bring fresh rosemary to school. What are you doing with that?
Well, I love rosemary. I have several large plants, bush size rosemaries. Mm-hmm. I bring one that's of manageable walking size into my classroom where it provides me with much of what a fig tree does, except it never loses its leaves. And oftentimes I'll walk around the classroom with that plant just so that kids are exposed to the smells that rosemary offers. It has quite a strong smell. And I also offer to let kids eat it. Happy to pull off a sprig or two for anyone that's willing to try it. And the brave kids do. And I think it's a way to not only expose kids to nature, but it's also a way to expose them to eating real food, maybe unique flavors that they haven't tried before, and just giving them a broader view of what's out there in nature.
And why do you feel that in your role as an English teacher?
I think that's everyone's role, if they are connected to something meaningful like nature, to bring that connection into classrooms.
And what kind of reaction have you seen from your students over the years? Has there been sort of a shift, or has it always been just some teens are going to try it, some teens are like, you're crazy?
Probably the latter. Probably the latter. They all shake their heads. They know I'm the crazy plant lady, and they get it. I always tell them they're welcome to come to my yard in the summer and pick grapes and wander around if they would like to. Yeah.
And full disclosure, that is how I met you, wandering around your yard. And it's quite dramatic to see from the street because it is almost exclusively edible. Is everything that you're growing, it's pretty close.
Except for what really needs to be here, just to make me happy. I don't eat zinnia flowers, but they're gorgeous. All parts of things are pretty edible, from lilac blossoms to grapes and grape leaves, which make mean dolmas. Mm. We have currant bushes lining the boulevard, and currant leaves make great tea. Most of it is pretty edible, except for your standard urban grasses.
And this is just something that you're doing in your own yard. Roughly, what's the square footage of your yard here?
Oh, that's a really great question. Ask Thor, who I should probably mention here as the primary, or certainly my partner in green crime. So,
in green crime, why do you call it that?
Oh goodness, we have had some run-ins with the city as far as regulations and plant height and such. So, yeah,
yeah, because there has been a little bit of a push in certain cities to increase the amount of pollinator species that you see in places, or, you know, some places have turned the median over into plants, and some places have put in no-mow grasses, for example. Have you ever been approached by anyone in terms of trying to share some of that knowledge and managing it so that it's wild but also responsible within an urban space?
I actually get approached all the time. If I am in my front yard, someone will stop. And usually I offer rhubarb and currants and grapes. But we always talk about the way to turn a boulevard into food. So, yeah, I get a lot of people approaching me about it.
Do you get any angry people at all?
No. I've had complaints. I like to think it was innocent realtors that were trying to sell houses on my block that maybe were having a hard time and thought my wild, chaotic yard had something to do with it. But for the most part, people have been supportive.
I'm just thinking of somebody coming into your yard going, what the heck is going on? And you're just giving them food immediately and then showing them what's happening. And then also, you're an English teacher. You're bringing these plants into the classroom. Are you ever not a teacher?
Oh, long-time parent, long-time teacher. Yes, early in the morning, I am selfishly not a teacher. I hope.
What do you mean, I hope?
Well, I suppose I do a lot of writing in the morning, and sometimes I write about things that I think could be improved in the world. And sometimes I share those pieces of writing. So I suppose that might fall into the realm of teacher as well.
So going back to the square footage of the yard, it is a big in-town lot, but it's not overwhelming. But let's talk about the yields that you are able to get from just a home garden here. Are you more or less able to not have to go to the grocery store for produce in the summer? How long does this last?
We certainly have the ability to put up for the entire year as far as preserved items. We're still working through last year's onions and garlic, as this year's onions and garlic are about ready for harvest. We dry tomatoes for year-round use, and I probably have enough dried tomatoes to last me for about a decade, so we tried to cut back this year. But, boy, we've probably had 100 tomato plants in the gardens at a time here.
Wow.
There's a good amount of food here to keep us in produce year-round.
And you also run a small farm with your husband, Thor.
We do, yeah. Yeah, there's we have a 40-acre farm north of Moorhead, right outside of Shelley, Minnesota, where we used to run a CSA, which is probably where this all came from. We left the farm, but the farm couldn't leave us. Up at the farm, we have a lot of, we have a bit of a food forest there. Thor is working on hybrid hazelnuts and slowly turning that acreage over to perennial fruits and such that will that need little tending and offer a great deal of food for the community, as long as we can figure out a way to get it to the community.
Yeah, because if I'm not mistaken, it was one of the earliest CSAs in this area.
Yes. I met Thor when he was running a CSA, and that was in 2011, and he had been running it for quite some time already at that time.
So I'm not sure if this really qualifies as a house plant, but obviously to run a CSA or even to have a yard and a garden that is as productive as yours is, you have to be starting seeds early. When does the gardening season start for Jacqueline and Thor?
January. We have a very, very large growing rack. We call it Big Blue, that oftentimes when we feel like large scale needs to be seeded, we'll put it up. It's about 10 feet long and 3 feet wide, big enough for planting trays and such. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in January you need to start onions and leeks. In February you're starting peppers and flowers and herbs, and yeah, January.
Is there a change in the air in your house as those seeds start to come along?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it just, everything's more breathable when you have lots of plants around you. Yeah.
Now, we talked in the beginning of this conversation for National Take Your Houseplant Out for a Walk Day, what plants are doing for us. But you have this relationship that seems to be sort of, you know, giving and taking, and not necessarily distinguishing between giving and taking, always sort of a cycle there. What are we doing for houseplants, specifically on Take Your Houseplant for a Walk Day? Why do they sometimes need to be moved around?
They need sun. They need the right environment. They need to go from one side of the house to a different side of the house, depending on where we're sitting during the year. Mm-hmm. We live where the sun is not straight up above us in December, so we have to figure out which window mm-hmm. the plants will do well in. Mm-hmm. And they require movement. They require the right amount of water and good care. Yeah.
What are the most common mistakes that people are making with houseplants?
Probably overwatering, underwatering, putting them where there isn't enough light. Those would probably be the majors.
Do you have favorite house plants?
I do. I have some aloe that I'm really quite fond of. It's actually from a plant that my mom dug up while camping in New Mexico. She put it on a paper plate on a wet paper towel, and stuck it in a Ziploc bag and brought it home to me. And it has been prolific in creating babies. And so it is now in probably 5 different pots, and is it's fun to say I have a wild aloe that I've domesticated here. I don't know if I've actually domesticated it, but it seems to stay in its pot and go where I ask it to go, so...
And your mom took that on quite a long walk if it came from New Mexico.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. It trekked a bit.
I feel like I hear that kind of story so often with people who love gardens is, you know, this plant reminds me of my mother. This plant reminds me of my grandmother. Now, you are also a mother. Kids are at that age where they don't necessarily appreciate mom's wisdom just yet, but what do you hope that you will pass along?
Honestly, I hope more than anything that eventually they grow their own gardens. I think it's an important thing to do in the world to nurture not only the environment we live in, but also our bodies with food that is good from the soil. And it is that reciprocal relationship. I think it teaches us a care of the earth that is so very important, and care of our own selves. And also every gardener has learned the art of sharing, because there is a time when zucchini mm-hmm. Takes over, and yeah. And we run around town, and anybody that has a car that's unlocked mm-hmm. will stick zucchini in. Yeah, you've been
yeah.
there?
Yeah. There's a national sneak a zucchini onto your neighbor's porch day.
Yeah, it's an excellent day. So it's a great way to care for our communities as well. Yeah. So, yeah.
And as you're hauling these plants around, and I'm thinking again of the rosemary that you're taking to school, I mean, are you putting this in a wagon? Are you putting this in a backpack? Or are you just carrying, like, you know, a sprig of this? What does this look like?
It's a timed thing. Towards the end of the school year, I counted my plants and counted days of the school year that I had left. And I was on the third floor of the high school here at Moorhead. So carrying more than one plant a day would mean multiple trips. So one plant per day, I would bring it down with me at the end of the school day. And gradually, my space became plantless at school. And as sad as that was, it was also a key reminder that it would soon be time to lay in the garden.
Jacqueline, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Jacqueline Weber visiting with me about National Take Your Houseplants Out for a Walk Day coming up tomorrow. And please, if you do this, send pics to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Now, with a show that's all about fruits and now houseplants, you might think, hey, they don't like grass. Well, that is just not true. And here's biologist Chuck Allura with this week's Natural North Dakota essay, It's Not Just Grass.
When one looks out on those North Dakota pastures, an observer may see just grass. It might surprise you, but North Dakota's home to around 150 species of grasses. Some, of course, are introduced, but the vast majority are native, ranging from buffalo grass to slough grass. The grass family is one of the most important plant families. Our grain crops are domesticated grasses, and grasses form the bulk of forage for large herbivores around the world, from North American bison to African wildebeest. And of course, the North Dakota grasslands are very important to the livestock industry. Like other plant families, the various species of grasses occupy a wide range of habitats. Salt grass, for example, is found in alkaline soils, a harsh environment for plants. Sand dropseed is largely restricted to sandy soils. The introduced Kentucky bluegrass, on the other hand, can occupy a wide range of conditions. Grasses can be categorized by season of growth. There are cool season grasses, such as western wheatgrass, the needle grasses, and Kentucky bluegrass, that grow best during the cooler days of spring and fall. They don't do well during the warmer days of summer. Conversely, warm-season grasses such as blue grama, big blue stem, and switchgrass are slow to grow in the spring and become most productive during the warm days of summer, which is too warm for the cool-season species. A good way to relate to these differences is to think of the growth of wheat, a cool-season grass, as opposed to corn, a warm-season grass. Grasses also differ in growth form, such as sod-forming or rhizomatous, versus bunch grass. They also can differ significantly in palatability and nutrition as they grow and mature. As such, grass species can differ markedly in how they respond to grazing. Think of a pasture as a giant smorgasbord. Livestock or big game might relish a grass during one period or season, but ignore it in another. Some species are seldom used, while others are used heavily and are occasionally referred to as ice cream plants. Ranchers and other grassland managers need to understand those differences to manage the resources more effectively. So make a point of walking some native prairie this summer and observing the different grasses and the differences between them. There's much going on here, physiologically, ecologically, and in other ways. It's not all just grass. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them. Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 66 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives.
This is Dakota Daybook for July 26th. Alex Laren was not a nice man. United States Marshal James F. Shea described him as, quote, a mild-looking cuss, but for all that, he was a bad one, unquote. During the early 1900s, Laren and his gang of horse thieves operated mainly near the Canadian border, along the Mouse River. On one occasion, lawmen Jimmy Costello and Bob Gorman almost lost their lives in a confrontation with Laren. While on the train from Minot to Botno, the sheriff happened to see Laren on the trail, leading some horses he had undoubtedly stolen. Costello sought out Sheriff Gorman, and the two men tracked Laren down, catching up to him where he had camped for the night. When Laren pulled a gun, Gorman grabbed him, and Costello rushed in to help. Laren tried to shoot his captors, but in the struggle, he shot himself in the leg and subsequently surrendered. Laren had a long history with the law in the Dakotas and Canada. In 1900, he was arrested for stealing horses. Later, he tried to kill Sheriff Cole of Aberdeen, South Dakota. In May 1906, Sheriff Graydon of Washburn arrested Laren for crimes he committed in Canada, and the court said the identification was not sufficient to extradite him, and he was released. Laren spent time in the North Dakota penitentiary for stealing horses, but broke out. He also broke out of jail in Grand Forks, where he was serving time for grand larceny. North Dakotans sighed with relief when they learned that Alex Laren was dead. On this date in 1907, readers of the Washburn Leader learned the full story. A farmer's wife had heard that Laren was in the area. By that time, many farmhouses had telephones. She phoned her neighbors to spread the news. Thomas Kerr arrived from his nearby farm armed with a rifle. When he spotted Laren riding a stolen horse, Laren pulled his gun, but missed his shot when his horse shied. Kerr shot and killed him. It was announced that Kerr would not be charged for killing a very bad man. Laren was described as one of the, quote, worst criminals that ever terrorized the Dakotas, unquote. Dakotans were satisfied that he had met a fitting end. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Facebook is about to look really different. Coming soon, a feed of videos, kind of like what's found on one of its biggest competitors, TikTok.
Everyone's eyes are glued to TikTok and the way it works right now.
Facebook is still the biggest social network, but losing users. Will an overhaul win them back? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, such a fun read, the new Jason Bourne novel. It is definitely quite a page-turner. We visit with author Brian Freeman. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.